We're in Judges chapter 2, and I hope you read ahead just a little bit, and I think what you'll find is chapter 2 is that bridge chapter. It actually tells of the condition of the people, how they got to that condition, and basically I think the reason why God raised up the judges, because of the spiritual condition of the people. And so we'll look at that tonight, and God's call and God's questioning them concerning their decisions to go in another direction. And I think we'll also see some important points that we look at in our own life and our own walk. So verse 1 says, "Then the angel of the Lord came up from Gilgal to Bochim and said, 'I led you up from Egypt and brought you to the land which I swore to your fathers. And I said, I will never break my covenant with you.'" So who do we have speaking to the people of Israel at this time? The angel of the Lord. Question, do you think he's speaking to the whole assembly of Israel, or is he speaking through someone to the whole assembly of Israel? Anybody?
Do you think that the angel of the Lord himself was the one doing the speaking?
To the whole, I know he's doing the speaking. The question is, who's he speaking to? I mean, the message clearly is to Israel, okay?
Right.
But who's he speaking to? And how does the Bible tell us that God speaks to his people?
Someone that he
calls. Okay, so we would say through a prophet. Okay. Through a prophet. Quite likely, again, here, this is how I don't know. It seems like when you have a multitude, what they usually hear when God speaks is a rumbling, a thunder, something like that. I don't know of any occasion where the whole group actually heard what God said. Maybe the closest thing that we have would be at Jesus' baptism. But other than that, I don't know of another occasion where there's a possibility of actually one more than one person hearing what God said. And we're told in the Old Testament that God doesn't do anything, yet first he speaks to his people through the prophet. Okay, so we have the angel of the Lord. Who is the angel of the Lord in the Old Testament?
I just downloaded the commentary.
Did you? Okay.
I gotta keep up with you.
Go ahead.
It says that generally it's agreed that it's Jesus.
Okay, and the word Lord here is the one we translate Yahweh, okay? And this is, I use the term the pre-incarnate Christ, okay? And sometimes he appeared in a human form before he took on flesh, and other times he just spoke to the people. But this is not Gabriel, this is not Michael, this is a reference to deity. Okay, when it is termed this way, not an angel of the Lord, not an angel from the Lord, but the angel of the Lord refers to, again, to the pre-incarnate Christ, that is Christ. The same one who appeared to Abraham, okay, and who gave the covenant to Abraham? The angel of the Lord gave the covenant to Abraham. Now, when he appeared to Abraham, again, remember he appeared to him before he was going to go down and destroy Sodom and Gomorrah. It wasn't just the angel of the Lord, but it was the angel of the Lord and two other messengers. And you understand that the word that is translated messenger is the same word that's used for angel. So you may be an angel. If you're a messenger, you may be an angel. Okay, it's the same word. Okay. We're talking about in duty, not in... Okay? So, we have the angel of the Lord. Elsewhere that he spoke, just so you know, Genesis chapter 16, Genesis chapter 22, recorded for us, Numbers chapter 22. And it seems like prior to the time of the prophets, you have this visitation of the angel of the Lord to bring a message of, and it usually had to do with deliverance for Israel. Okay.
This is actually a question I've had. Is it the same way with the angel that appeared to Joshua when he was looking over the city? Do you know what I'm talking about?
In which one? Let's see.
Well, it goes back. It's in Joshua.
It'd be in Joshua
5.
Which city?
It's Jericho. So he's Jericho. Back in the wilderness.
Okay.
And he's fighting the angel who, or some. Assuming
it's
the same one.
Let's see. We'll go back there. It just takes a minute because it's only one book over. Okay, so in verse 13 it starts, I think. It says, "And it came to pass when Joshua was by Jericho, they lifted up his eyes and looked, and behold, a man stood opposite him with a sword drawn in his hand. And Joshua went to him and said, 'Are you for us or are you for our adversary?' And he said, 'No.' And so he said, 'No, but as a commander of the army of the Lord, I have now come.' And Joshua fell on his face to worship him and said to him, 'What does my Lord say to his servant?' Then the commander of the Lord's army said to Joshua, 'Take the sandal off your foot, for the place where you stand is holy.'" My answer would be, yes, it's the same. Why?
Well, he bowed down and worshiped.
Okay.
Him.
And will a true angel of God receive worship?
No. And the ground was also holy, which means God was there.
Right. Presence of the Lord. Yeah. Everybody agree? Anybody don't agree?
I can go with that.
Okay. All right. Any other questions on that, on the angel of the Lord? Okay. Usually referred to as deity. Okay. And again, the allowance of worship tells us something about him that distinguishes him from any other angel. But you know, and other than this angel, you have some angels described, but the personality or angels being made personal in the Old Testament, you really only have two, maybe three, that are actually personalized in the Old Testament. Who would those three be? Anybody know? You'd have Michael.
Gabriel.
You'd have Gabriel. Anybody else?
Woman, angel, the devil.
That's right, Lucifer. Yeah. Yeah. That they're really personalized in that way. Exactly. Okay. So, the angel of the Lord came up and he reminds them that it was he who led them out of Egypt. It was he who brought them out of captivity. But not only that, he not only led them out of there, he made a covenant with them. And it's interesting that in verse 1 it says, "My covenant." Okay, it wasn't an angel who made a covenant with the people of Israel. It was God who made a covenant with the people of Israel. Another indicator here that this is deity speaking here. Go ahead, Doug.
So I'm the first person.
Right.
All the way through this.
Right.
It's not God told me to give you this message or anything like that.
Right.
I did this.
Okay, when we look at this word, and I think Doug dealt with this some in the book of Acts, but it's a word that's used a lot, and in this thing is that word covenant. Covenant. If that's not spelled right, I'm sorry, teachers. Okay. Oh, thank you. Covenant equals promise. Stronger word, maybe. Agreement. Okay. A word that we use that is testament. We call Old Testament, New Testament, Old Covenant, New Covenant. Okay. All right. Two kinds of covenants in the Bible. What are they?
Unconditional.
Okay, unconditional. And conditional. This is unbreakable. Why? Because it's unconditional. It's solely based on God's word. I will do this. I promise you I will do this. Has nothing to do, the fulfillment of it has nothing to do with the actions. Okay? Once you enter into that covenant, or God enters into that covenant with you, it's unbreakable. We would say some covenants that would fall under this thing, the first one that we have in the Bible is the Abrahamic covenant. Okay? Which is a promise to the nation of Israel. Actually, to Abraham before there was a nation of Israel. But that covenant was carried on from Abraham to Isaac to Jacob. So we don't have to wonder the line that God carried that through, because the Old Testament tells us, okay? Part of that covenant we hold is the land. We have a reference here to this covenant, okay? Now the question is, which covenant is he speaking of? And as you read on, I think it makes it clear clear that it's possibly the Abrahamic covenant, but there's not only the Abrahamic covenant in the Old Testament, which, remember, the Abrahamic is unconditional, but the, a conditional, two conditional ones in the Old Testament is the Mosaic and the Davidic. Moses and David. Okay? Basically, they say this. Okay, God says to Abraham, I covenant with you and I give you this land and you will be my people in perpetuity, forever. Okay? With David and Moses, what God says, he says, if you do not join yourself with the people of the land, if you do not worship other idols, then I will give you safety in the land and no one will ever come against you and be able to remove you from the land. See the condition there? If, okay? An unconditional covenant is your salvation. Did you know your salvation is a covenant with God? And it is unconditional. Now, you understand there are some Christian groups that do not teach it's unconditional. They teach that you can lose your salvation. And it's dependent upon your actions, whether you keep it or whether you lose it. We believe that if you're genuinely saved, then you're eternally saved. So if you're genuinely saved, you've entered into a covenant with God through His Son Jesus Christ that is unbreakable. And remember the words of Jesus at the Lord's Supper. What did He say? This cup is a new covenant in my blood. So he made it clear that it's a new covenant. Question for us, is it unconditional or conditional? I would say it's unconditional. If you're in it, it's God who holds you. And you don't lose it because of behavior. Now, you can harm your fellowship with God and your walk with God because of your behavior, for sure. You can harm your testimony, for sure. But once you're a child of God, then you are genuinely a child of God. I didn't get you all these, did I? Okay? Any questions on the covenant thing? Any opinion about which covenant he's referring to here? Okay. It seems like he's going to the greater covenant to me. Let me just throw it out there. The greater covenant. That is the unconditional one, the Abrahamic covenant. Okay. And the very act that they've come back into the land is a fulfillment of that covenant, or evidence of the fulfillment of that covenant. He's brought them back into the land. Remember, and he says, I brought you out of Egypt. And where does he bring them? He brings them back to the land that he has promised them and stuff. Okay, so let's read on. Okay, verse 2 says, and you shall make no covenant, or make no promises, make no treaties, make no testaments, all those words, with the inhabitants of this land. You shall tear down their altars, but you have not obeyed my voice. Why have you done this? So what is God saying to the people of Israel? And who's guilty of this? Well, we would say they're all the way back to Joshua, they're guilty of this, right? Because, and again, I see this second chapter almost as a parenthesis to tell us why the judges come into being. Okay, God's taking them back to Egypt under the leadership of Moses. They come to the edge of the Promised Land. Joshua takes them into the Promised Land. God uses Joshua to divide the land, to battle the inhabitants of the land. But at no time does Israel, even under the leadership of Joshua, do what God says. Okay, and there's a reason why God said clear out the land. It seems kind of harsh to us, doesn't it? Let's just be honest. It seems kind of harsh to us, some of the things that God told His people to do. But remember who He is. God knows what would happen to His people, or knew what would happen to His people if they did not obey Him. He knew God knows how weak we are. And we brag about how strong we are spiritually. God, everybody else will leave you, but I'll never leave you. And we have examples of that, like Peter, right? He said, if everybody else leaves you, Jesus, I won't leave you, Lord. I'll never leave you. And Jesus says, you know what, Peter? Before this night's over, you're going to deny me three times. You know that was a real shot to his ego.
Oh, yes.
Okay? And sometimes we need a shot to our ego because we're not quite as strong as we think we are. And Paul reminds us of that. He said, be careful when you think you're strong, lest that's the point that you're going to fall.
That's right.
Okay? And so God knows the nature of man, and He knew that if they did not clear out the land, and He not only told them to clear out the land, But he proved, I mean, think about the first battle. He proved in the very first battle going to land, which you referred to a little bit ago. First battle, crossing the Jordan, going into the land. He proved that he would give them victory. Did he not? What did they have to do at Jericho? Basically nothing. In the sense of warfare, right? I always say that's a quite curious war plan. You know, they would take someone off the Joint Chiefs of Staff if he'd come into the meeting and said, "Hey guys, I got a plan. This is how we're going to take Afghanistan. We're just going to walk around it." You know, so when you look at that, God proved in the very first battle that He would do what needed to be done to clear the land. And all he asked him to do is walk. That's the story of Jericho. All I'm asking you to do is walk. I'm asking you to be there. I'm asking you to trust me, and I will give you the land. And did he not say, "I've already given you the land"? All they had to do is walk in it and be obedient in that walk. Okay? And it wasn't long till you know, when you look at going into the promised land, I think there's such a parallel between that and what Doug taught when he taught in the book of Acts and the first church. You see the power of God. You see the power of God in Jericho. You see the power of God in the first church. You see God doing things among people's life that they could not do on their own in Jericho. You see it in the first church. You know, he's transforming people's life. And it isn't long, right after God just shows his power, either in Jericho or in the first church, that Satan raises up his head. And so you have the Battle of Jericho won, and then you have this man by the name of Achan who decides he's not going to be obedient to God, and you have disobedience to God right away. In the first church, you have God moving in a great way, and then you have this husband and wife who decide we don't have to be honest with God. You know, I wonder how much, and I know it's a question we can't answer, but you just have to wonder how much would have been done very quickly in both places if the people of God would have just trusted God and not let Satan have a place, either in Old Testament times or in the church. You have to wonder the same thing of our churches today. Okay? So, God is reminding them that he's the one that delivered them. He's the one that has established a covenant with them. And he told them as a part of his purpose that they're to go into the land and they're to make no covenants with the people of the land. He doesn't want them to sit down at the tables with them. He doesn't want them to compromise with them. He doesn't want them to make treaties. No treaty here. You know? And basically, I would not say to you, God is saying, "This is your land." What I would say God is saying is, "This land belongs to me, and I want you in there. Because that's my covenant." Okay? And so, he gets to the end there and he says, "But you have not done what I've said. You have not obeyed me. Why have you done this?" Jesus says in the Gospel of Luke, "You call me Lord, Lord, and then you do not do the things that I tell you to do." It makes no sense. Okay? Why do we call him Lord if we have no intention of doing what he says? God would say the same thing here to Israel. You know, why? And if you think it out biblically and even our testimony, why would we ever disobey God? We know what it leads to, don't we? We also know what obeying God leads to, but we're stubborn and we disobey him. And so he asks that question of them. All right, verse 3. "Then I also said, I will not drive them out before you, but they shall be thorns in your side, and their gods will be a snare to you." And so, because of their disobedience, what did God say? And notice here, it's not because God is impotent to do this. God could do it. He's all powerful. I think that this answers a lot of questions where people say, you don't believe in the power of God. If you believe in the power of God, you wouldn't have this in your life. This wouldn't be going on and stuff like that. The question is not the power of God. God can do anything. And even in this occasion, the question is not the power of God. God could drive these people completely. He can annihilate them. Every one of them. And he proved that over and over again in different scenarios, doesn't he? Remember with the Syrian army when they're coming in on Jerusalem? What's he do? 185,000? Is that the number?
Yep.
Dead. In one night. And Judah never has to raise a sword. Okay, Ezekiel chapter 38 talks about something very similar, but on a much larger scale, which is going to happen. you know, and which is actually in our future. You know, God is able, but God also has a plan. And God has chosen to use His people. And we would say in the Old Testament, clearly He's chosen to use Israel to be His people, to make a difference. And if you read the book of Isaiah, you see that he called Israel not just to just so Israel could say, hey, look, we're the promised people. He called Israel to be a testimony to the Gentiles. Okay? And now God has established His church. We're His people. We're called. You understand this. God could save the city of Fountain Hills in an instant, right? He could make everybody in this community believe in Him. Not a matter of if He could. But He has a plan. And we're a part of that plan. And our disobedience to that plan, clearly, as I shared Sunday night out of Isaiah, clearly has an impact upon the community that we're in. And our obedience also has an impact. Okay?
We're not a whole lot different from these people.
No, we're not.
You know, He said, I will not drive them out before you. What God is saying is, this is what you want, then this is what you get. Let's see if you can, in your own power, drive these people out. He says the same thing to us. This is what you want, and let's see you do it in
Let's see you do it your own self, yeah. And what we have is we have God's people being ineffective, not because they have to be, but because they've chosen to be. You understand that? We're not powerless in this generation because we have to be. The Holy Spirit's alive and well. But we've chosen our own path. All right? Last part of verse 2, he says, but you have not obeyed my voice. Why have you done this? So they made covenants. What are some of the groups that they made covenants with? They made covenants with the Canaanites. They made covenants with the Amorites. They made covenants with the Jebusites. And all these were people that lived in the land at that time. Parasites.
There's a lot of
tithes. Yeah, they're the tithes. All the tithes, you know. Okay. Again, we read some of that last week, did we not? When we look in the first chapter, and some of them they made covenants with, some of them they made slaves, but they did not do what God told them to do. Okay? And so verse 3, God says, for this reason, because you have chosen to be disobedient. It's not just the reason that they made covenants. The problem with the covenants is God said, don't do it. Making agreements with people is not necessarily evil unless God tells you not to make agreements with them. Everybody understand that? The sin is not the covenant, the sin or the agreement. The sin is being disobedient to God. Sometimes we do the, quote, right thing for the wrong reason, and the right thing can be a sin if God says don't do it.
Well, right there, God was trying to prevent them from having their God being a snare to them.
Yeah.
But they didn't get the people out, so He's showing them what He would have prevented by them.
Right.
Them out.
And so what He says is, I will not drive them out. In other words, He's going to, not because He can, as we said, but He's going to withhold His assistance in driving these people out. And Israel's going to be like we are. How are we with when it comes to the work of God? There are times we just want God to work, and we want the world around us to change for the better. And so we humble ourselves for a little bit, and we seek the face of God for a little bit, and then we forget, and we try to do it on our own again. Even after God may demonstrate, you know, and that's the same thing they'll do. They'll get fed up with all these different ites in there, and they'll call out to God, and they'll beg to God, and they'll ask God's forgiveness and all this stuff, but it won't last long. And He tells them right. And notice here, He tells them right from the beginning, "I will, because of your decision, I will not drive them out." You remember, this is the second. This really is the second time we have this pretty strong statement from God. The first time is when they first came to the land. They had just been out of Egypt just for a brief period of time. They came to the edge of the land. They sent in the 12 spies, remember? And the 12 spies came back with a report too. Joshua and Caleb said, let's do it. God said, let's do it. I have to wonder, again, if they would have walked in the power and the faith in God in that time, you know, if. There's all these ifs. Okay? But the 10 said, no, we can't do it. And so the people listened to the 10 rather than the 2. And God says, okay, you won't go in? You're going to want it. This generation will not even see the promised land.
They forgot that the majority was God, not
that's right.
The people majority.
If you think about it, the majority, we have this concept as American that the majority is always right. But we, even in our own history, we found that the majority is not always right. You know, a lot of civil rights laws have been enacted because the majority wasn't right in how they treated some people. It was a law, but that didn't make it right. And I think sometimes we have that idea sometimes with, you know, even within the body of Christ. You know, we Baptists have this thing that we are a democracy, but we're not a democracy. We're not a democracy. If Christ is not leading this church, it doesn't matter how the people vote. And that's what we need to be careful of. You know, as we talk about where God's leading the body. And again, very rarely does he speak to the whole body. And I think in the church age, he clearly speaks to all people at different times and stuff. All right, so I will not drive them out, and he says, and they shall be thorns in your sides. So they're going to be an irritant in your side. Not only that, an irritant, but he chooses the word to use the word thorn. So it's going to be a painful irritant. Okay, in your side, and he says, and their gods will be a snare to you. So their god, their gods will trip you up. Okay, a snare is anybody grew up at the time when you knew what a snare was? I don't think kids today even know what a snare is and stuff, you know.
Like a trap.
But it's like a trap, okay? But it's a trap that catches you and holds you, not necessarily a trap that kills you, okay? But you can't get away from it. There's the snare. You'll not get away from their gods. Because you've chosen this, they're going to remain among you, and they're going to be that thorn in your side, and they're going to be a snare to you for all your generations. You know, it's still that way today. It's an incredible thing. All right, verse 4. So it was when the angel of the Lord spoke these words to all the children of Israel that the children lifted up their voices and wept, and they called the name of that place Bochim. And a sacrifice there to the Lord. The word Bochim means weepers or weeping. And there are the commentators I read said that there is no place or city called Bochim. That most of them believe that this took place at Shiloh, at the place where God met his people. Okay? Remember, prior to Jerusalem and stuff, the tabernacle was kept. Once they were in the land, the tabernacle itself was kept at Shiloh. Okay? Nice name. Someone ought to name their kid that. So the ones I read today almost unanimously thought that it's a temporary name for a temporary event. They called that place the weeping place or the place of weepers. Okay? Questions or comments on that? What is interesting here to me, it seems like at least the leadership and the people that heard what the leadership said understood that they had no recourse now. Seems like that to me. God says, this is what's going to be. And what's it drive them to? It drives them to sorrow, but their sorrow isn't going to change anything. There are always consequences for sin, of disobeying God. And we certainly can be sorrowful that we have been disobedient to God, but our sorrow will not change the consequences. We need to understand that. Now here's what I want you to get. They were disobedient to God, but their disobedience to God did not break the covenant. Everybody got that? The covenant was intact. The unconditional Abrahamic covenant was intact. Why? Because it was based on what God said and not based upon that. Okay, but though the covenant was not broken, their disobedience led to consequences. They remained God's chosen people. They remained the people of the land and the Abrahamic covenant, but there were consequences for their disobedience. And I would say to you, we are in that unconditional covenant under Christ's blood. And there are consequences for our disobedience to God too. And we can be sorrowful for that. But some things we do, guys, there are going to be consequences that are not going to be changed just because we're sorry about it. You know, you think about disobedient acts of sin that affect other people's lives. Okay? How do you pull that back? How do you stop that? You know, maybe you heard the story about the person that was a gossip in the church and stuff and finally said something that just hurt a lot of people and came to the pastor's office and filled with sorrow and said, "Pastor, I want to make this right." And he used the illustration of a feather pillow on a windy day. And he said and talked about, "You ever seen a feather? What would happen to a feather pillow on a windy day? You put it out there, you do it like that, and those feathers would go out everywhere." And he said, and what are you supposed to be like if you tried to get every one of those feathers back in? And of course, it'd be impossible. You understand what I'm saying there? Our sins are forgiven because we're under the covenant. But there are still consequences. And unfortunately, there are a lot of Christians, you know, we got Christians on both ends of this. One group says, if you do any sin, you can lose your salvation. And you got people on the other side say, "Well, I'm saved, I'm secure, so I don't really believe there's any. I've already been forgiven for all my sins, so there's no real consequences." Well, yes, there are. You know, churches have been destroyed. Families have been destroyed because of disobedience to God. Doesn't mean that they're not Christian. It just means that there are consequences for those sins. So what holds true for Israel here, the consequences, holds true for us also. If the church wants to be in bondage to Satan, the church can be in bondage to Satan. If the church wants to be weak and ineffective in the world, we can be weak and ineffective in the world. It's not that it's God's plan, but that's a consequence of our decision to try to go it alone. And when we go it alone, we're being disobedient to God. Any input before we move on? First five verses. He reviews what he's done. He talks about their disobedience. He talks about the consequences of disobedience. They're sorry. They're sad for it. But that does not take away the consequences. And like so many of us, their sorrow doesn't last very long. They don't change anything. You know? Sometimes you ever think about it, that sometimes what we teach as sorrow is more, "I'm sorry I got caught," not "I'm sorry I did it." You know. All right, verse 6 then. It says, "And when Joshua had dismissed the people, the children of Israel went each to his own inheritance to possess the land." So you see what he's doing? He's recounting now what took place. So they've gone in, they've taken the land, and now after this meeting, which, again, the scholars believe was probably at Shiloh under leadership of Joshua. He's recounting all this, okay? Joshua releases them. Well, where does he release them to? He releases them to the place where they're designated. On your map there, you see there, they're designated areas where the tribes were to be placed, where the tribes were placed under the command of God. Now we go to verse 7. "So the people served the Lord all the days of Joshua." Obediently? No. Completely? No. But clearly the days of Joshua were better than the days that they were entering into now. Okay? So they served the Lord. Part of that service, I would say, is the impact of Joshua. Clearly that's there. The leadership of the Lord through Joshua is there. And they served the Lord all the days of Joshua and all the days of the elders who outlived Joshua. Okay? I want you to see what... let me just finish that. And it says, "who had seen all the great works the Lord had done, which he had done for Israel." So, which generation is he talking about here? Which generation who came in the land? The first generation. Joshua and all the elders that outlived Joshua. Not the next generation from Joshua, but the same generation as Joshua, but they outlived him. In other words, they saw what God had done. That first generation in the promised land is the first generation he's talking about. And isn't it interesting that what we're going to see is one generation away, you have a people that move into complete idolatry. After the display of God's mighty power to get them in the land in the first place. It doesn't take long for people to forget. to forget who God is, to forget what God has done in their life, to put their trust in that which seems more convenient, and maybe, I might even say, less troublesome. You know, God, this is heavy what you've called us to do, to follow you, to trust you, to do all these things. It's so much easier just to join with what everybody else is doing because they've got it all sort of planned out there, how to work it. So it says they served the Lord during that first generation. Again, that is a generalized statement. Again, I want you to understand, he's not saying 100% of the people, 100% of the time, 100% followed the Lord. It just means that the people of Israel overall were God-following, God-fearing people at that time. Okay? Verse 8. Now Joshua the son of Nun, the servant of the Lord, died when he was 110 years old. Okay? And it goes on to say, and they buried him within the border of his inheritance at Timnah-Heres in the mountains of Ephraim on the north side of Mount Gaash. Now, so we have the death of Joshua recorded for us. This is not happening as it's been written. He's recounting this. The writer of Judges is recounting this. And so now he comes to verse 10. He says, when all the generations had gathered to their fathers, when all that generation had gathered to their fathers, another generation arose up after them who did not know the Lord, nor the work which he had done for Israel. Okay? Now this is a good question. Or at least it is in my mind. Y'all can see if it's good. Does it mean that they did not hear about it? Or now are they talking about... They were a generation that had, when it says they did not know, does it mean they did not know in the sense that no one had told them about it? Or does it mean that they did not know in the sense that they did not see it themselves? What do y'all think?
I think it's that they didn't see, but they did know from their parents. That's what I would think.
Okay. Anybody else? You think they knew about it? They heard about it?
Yes. You know, they had to hear all the miracles, so many miracles, getting out of Egypt.
What was the point of the miracles? Now tie this in with Jesus' miracle. Jesus was a miracle man, right? Okay. But then at the end of his ministry, did he not condemn them because all they wanted to see is one more miracle?
Yeah.
So he condemned them. Okay, so that they knew of the miracles, and even in the time of the miracles, whether it be the miracles of God in the Old Testament or the miracles of Jesus in the New Testament, the point wasn't the miracles. Do you see that? The point was not the miracles. Does that make sense to you? What was the point? If the point was not the miracles, what was the point?
The point of the miracles was to show them who God was, to provide them. You know, the manna, the water, everything in the desert, the quail. You know, he did those great acts.
So that they would do what?
Trust.
We sing another part of that song. And?
Okay.
And obey. Is that not the same reason for the miracles of Christ? It was a revelation. Old Testament was a revelation of who God was to his people. New Testament is a revelation of who Jesus is to his people. Okay, but not just so everybody can stand around and say, wow, look what God did. Or look what Jesus did. But it was to reveal himself so they could they would trust him, that they would be obedient to him and stuff. Not just so they could see another miracle. And I think that's what Jesus condemns ultimately when the religious leaders were saying to him, you know, just show us one more thing and that will suffice. It wouldn't suffice. They'd want to see something else. Okay? And Jesus finally says, you're wicked people. Because all you want to see is a sign. He wasn't condemning the sign. He was condemning their attitude of desiring one more sign. And Jesus said, I'm not going to show you anything else except for the sign of Jonah, which is the resurrection. Okay? So, when we come here, we have again this verbiage that's used here. There's a generation that has come into being now that did not know the Lord nor the work which he had done for Israel. That word know there does speak of a very personal knowledge. In the same way we would say we know the Lord. There are people who know of the Lord, but they don't know the Lord. There are people who know of the works of the Lord, but know of the works of the Lord, but they don't know the works of the Lord. See, part of your testimony is that you know the works of the Lord because he's done a work in you, right? You've experienced the Lord and you've experienced the work of the Lord. There are people who can talk about it theoretically and talk about Him theoretically, but it's a whole different thing to know them and to know Him. And so now we have a generation that does not know the Lord, nor do they know or have they experienced the power of God in their life. Why? Because God's quit being powerful? No. That's answered up there, right? It's answered up there. Because they chose to do it on their own strength. They chose to go their own way. And God said, you don't want to see my power? You don't want me to reveal myself? Then I won't. But now we have a consequence, don't we? We have a whole other generation that won't know God, nor the power of God, because the generation before them refused to obey God.
Except when it gets real nitty-gritty, they're going to be quick to turn to Him.
Oh, of course.
So,
where are you going to run when you...
In the name of God,
right.
They just don't have that relationship.
Right. And where are you... And people... Think about it. Did not our country do that on September 11th?
Mm-hmm.
Did not our country do that? Where people who have no consideration of God most of the time in their life, when we were under attack, they ran to God. God save us. And you know, you want to ask the question, which God are you talking about? The God that we've rejected, the God that we've denied and stuff like that? It's the nature of man. It's the nature of man. Okay? Our country knows enough to know there is a God. Okay? We know enough to that, and we know to run to Him when we get in trouble. But how quickly do we forget that we called out to Him? As quick as Israel did. And we're guilty of that too. Not just our country, but our churches are guilty of that too. God, we're going through a difficult situation as a church. We need You to act. God acts, and we say, thank you God for acting. We'll call on You the next time we get in that trouble.
That's how I was before I was saved in Catholicism. I just called out to God when I was in trouble or my family, you know, or illness, or when things were happy. I did praise Him for that, but I never thought of Him every day, every minute like I do now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I had that head knowledge.
And I would say to you that if someone who was a born-again Christian would have talked to you about a personal relationship, it would have been foreign language to you.
Well, it was when I was being witnessed.
Yeah, that's right. It's like, but once you have it, it's like what you just said, Carol. You just know He's there. You know He's real. And it's not a matter that you need to run to Him for this critical thing or anything. He's just there. And so He's there in the good times. He's there in the bad times. He's there. He's our sustainer. It's a wonderful thing. There's a comfort that God gives just because He's there, and part of that comfort is the knowledge that we know Him in a personal way, the way that religious people cannot know Him.
I think there was a lack of teaching.
Oh, I agree.
A generation in Old Testament was what, 40 years? No.
20.
Well, that's if you listen to Hal Lindsey, that's what he said. But I don't necessarily agree with that.
No, I'm just saying
that is a believed thing.
Okay.
The question is, was he talking about a generation? Clearly, it seems to me here he's talking about all those that were alive in Joshua's generation that saw it are dead now. So
right.
I don't know that he's talking about a specific amount of years here. He's just saying all those who saw are gone now. And another generation comes up.
They all died at the same time.
Right.
I know what you're saying.
Right.
But I think there was definitely, as they began to die off, there became less teaching.
Exactly.
Or maybe less an interest by the people. They're trying to get on with their lives. They have things to do, you know.
And what you just said is so important. They were in the land, and it was okay. These people we don't like very much. They're not much like us. They're a little bit different and stuff, and they do crazy things. But it's okay. We're doing all right. We're in the land, and they get on with life. These are people that get on with life, and they forget the things of God. And they neglect to teach their children the things of God. And remember, teaching our children, again, I think in our modern church we need to remember, teaching our children the things of God is not just sitting down and reading to them from a book about God. Teaching them about God is walking in God before them. Right? I mean, if they don't see it in our lives, they're not going to believe anything we read to them. Because we can read Mother Goose to them, and we can read out of the Bible, a story out of the Bible to them, and if we don't live it, They're gonna balance those two things out and think they're co-equal. Just another book mom or dad read to me, because it means nothing to them. Okay. So I would agree with Doug on that too. That we have a lack of teaching, a lack of consideration of God, a lack of personal knowledge of God, and personal knowledge of His power. You know. And I'm sure over time some of them got to the place where they began to think, you know, this is just some old story Grandpa said, you know, a few years ago, but nobody believes it anymore. Just one of those old wives' tales, you know, that old people talk about. But all them old people are gone now, so, and we've got our own ways. We don't need all that old stuff.
To me, we even have somewhat of a more modern version of that in just like the World War II, where the people that were in that war are something. Died off now, and then you've got people pop up and being said, podcast never even happened. And, you know, that could be a generation right there that.
Yeah, and who would have thought within, what, 60 years that anybody would even consider saying something like that? But they do.
And that's contemporary.
We even have film of that. They didn't have film of this. Incredible how quickly people change. Which should remind us, we are really, the church is one generation from extinction. In a real, very real sense. And by the way, there are, not the church as a whole, because I believe the church as a whole certainly is going to be here when Jesus comes back. But there are certainly individual fellowships that one generation ago were vibrant, alive, strong, you know, moving in God. And now, you know, a few people. When I pastored in Tucson, there was a church called Columbia Street Baptist Church. Used to be the largest Southern Baptist church in the state of Arizona. Before North Phoenix was big, and all, I mean, it's a huge church in the sense of in that day. And when I was pastoring there in the 80s, we'd go over to their facility. They had 19 people. Now, part of what happened is the area around the church changed. But there was a handful of people that said, we're not going to hand this church over to any other people. We're going to keep it. So you have 19 people in this boarded up building that's made for 500 to 600 people at that time. And they wouldn't let the people that moved in the neighborhood be in their facility. And they said, well, we can't let them in there because they'll take over. It's crazy how people look at a building, isn't it? They'll take over, you know, as if it belongs to them instead of to the Lord. But it doesn't take long, does it? It doesn't take long. You know, certain things happen in churches. It doesn't even take a generation. It could be, you know, 6 months and you start seeing where have all the flowers gone, where have all the people gone. So, I've got to have a flashback. These kids don't know what I'm talking about there. So. Carol, I didn't know you were old hippie.
Oh yeah.
They
probably read.
Yeah. Well, you didn't live too far from there then, did you?
No.
No, okay.
But I wasn't there.
Okay. Oh, sure. All right, so let's move on. Verse 11. So it says, the children of Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord and served the Baals. Okay? Now, Baal. And here's what you have to understand. In the Hebrew, again, we have no vowels. Okay? Most of our King James and stuff will spell Baal like B-A-A-L. The A and the E sound almost exactly the same in the Hebrew when you pronounce it. Okay? Most have become at least the one when I studied the Hebrew and then talked to some of these Hebrew scholars, they believe that Baal would have been better spelled like this. Okay, and the point is, the word is El, Ba-El, Ba-El. El is God. Okay, El is God, and El, the term El we use for either the one true God or false God. In the same way that we would say God, we say God, and we're either the context says whether we're referring to God the Creator or a god, a false god. Okay? So, El is used for God. Okay? Elohim is also used for God. It's the plural of El. Okay? We know it refers to the Trinity. Okay? The word Lord that we looked at earlier is a word that translates to us Yahweh. But again, that's with vowels added that we don't really know. It's the name that you don't name. It's the word that you don't use. It's the I am. Yahweh is I am. When God answered Moses, when he said, "Who shall I say sent me?" Yahweh sent you. And some people use the word Jehovah, which is the same word that they use there. Okay, so Baal or Baal, we'll just say that, is a false god. He is a false deity. Okay. He is one of the gods of the Canaanites, and a pretty powerful god. You have him mentioned a lot in this section of, particularly in this section of Israel's history. Okay, God warned them that if they did not drive these people out, that they would eventually go the direction of these people. You'll read the Old Testament prophets when you get to the Old Testament prophets, and God likens what Israel did spiritually to a husband or to a wife stepping out on their spouse. In other words, committing adultery. Okay, and if you think about it, adultery in the physical sense is a spouse stepping out on their spouse, going and joining themselves with another person that is not, that they're not married to. That's adultery. And God said that my people Israel have committed adultery against me. They've gone and they've joined themselves to other gods, which are not gods at all. And it's interesting, if you read in our study in Isaiah, in the 44th chapter, it's almost like God through Isaiah is making fun of these people. He says something like this. He says, you have this piece of wood. Remember this from the other day? You have this piece of wood that you just cut down. Okay, with one third of it, you warm yourself. With another third of it, you cook your food. And with the other third of it, you let some craftsman form it into some image that you bow down and worship. And it's almost like God is using Isaiah to say, how can people get to such a place as that? And Paul answers that in Romans chapter 1. He says, when man makes the decision to worship the creation rather than the creator, then God hands them over to a reprobate mind, where they will do that which is completely unnatural, in every sense of the word. Because the sin is that they've replaced God with another god, which is not a god at all. And we're going to have to stop here, because of our time, but I want you to get this before we leave here. There is no God except God. Everybody got that? Every false god is not God. Okay? It is men who make that which is not God into God. And it's the worst thing that we can do. That's why, you know, the first thing that God says in the commandments is what? You will have no other gods before me. And he's not giving them power. He's not giving those gods even acknowledging their existence as true gods. He's saying what men do. This is the reason why Paul said in the New Testament, he says some people say you don't eat meat offered to idols, and what does Paul say? Paul says, it doesn't matter to me. He said, Paul says, to me it's just a hunk of meat, right? Okay? Why? Why did Paul say it? And Paul said, because there are no other gods other than God. These things that you've offered this meat to doesn't even exist in my mind. I give no credibility to this God that does not exist. You may, but I won't. And when God becomes everything to his people, there are no other gods that exist. It's when God's people gets their eyes off of him that they create gods from their own imaginations.
Like carving a tree,
exactly. Right. From their own imaginations.
There's persuasive arguments out there even today. I want to come and tell you about different things. We numbers. One of the big ones. You just came out, okay, and you're in my territory, the land of Canaan, okay? And so you say, you know what? I'm gonna make peace with you. So we'll live in the same area. And I'll say that's cool.